Welcome to another episode of New Books in Islamic Studies. I'm your host, Christian Peterson. For each episode, we choose a new book that's especially interesting, and we chat with the author of that book. For this program, I had the pleasure of speaking with Julianne Hammer about her wonderful new book, American Muslim Women, Religious Authority and Activism, More Than a Prayer, which came out in 2012 from University of Texas Press. In 2005, Amina Wadud led a mixed-gender congregation of Muslims in prayer. This event became the focal point of substantial media attention and highlighted some of the tensions within the Muslim community. However, this prayer gathering was the culmination of a series of events and embodied several ongoing intra-Muslim debates. In this great new book, Hammer outlines the circumstances leading up to the prayer event and employs it as a point of convergence to explore the multiple discourses surrounding Muslim gender issues. The debates following the prayer fell into two discursive frameworks, legal and symbolic. Hammer explores these themes through a broader body of sources written by American Muslim women, both in relation to exegetical projects or legalistic frameworks leading towards gender equality or human rights. While gender remains central to the arguments of the book, Hammer uses the subject to examine various issues related to contemporary Islam, including participation, leadership, law, media, and self-representation. In our all-too-brief conversation, we discuss the disintegration of traditional modes of authority, quote-unquote progressive Muslims, embodied tafsir, feminism, the hijab, politics of book covers, mosques, networks, but we were only able to scratch the surface of this wonderful book. I encourage you all to pick it up and read through it, and in the meantime, enjoy our conversation. Welcome to another episode of New Books in Islamic Studies. Today I have the pleasure of speaking with Julianne Hammer about her wonderful new book, American Muslim Women, Religious Authority and Activism, More Than a Prayer. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm okay. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks again for making time to talk to me. The book is very, very good. You do a lot in it, and we will certainly not get to talk about all of it, but I will try to squeeze it all in here. But before we get into the contents of the book, could you give us a little bit about your background, how you got into Islamic studies?
So there's this mythical story of how I was in 11th grade when I decided that I really wanted to learn Arabic. And I was told that women shouldn't do that because they couldn't actually work in Middle Eastern countries, which was an interesting experience, but I'm not easily deterred. And so when I finished high school, I applied for a program at Humboldt University in Berlin, where I grew up, in Asian and African studies. It was a very big sort of unit that had different subunits to it. And I was actually scheduled to become an interpreter for Japanese and Korean, which I wasn't very excited about until I went there on my first day of university in 1990 and asked if I could learn Arabic instead. And they said, well, we don't have Arab studies or Arabic literature, but we do have an Islamic Studies Institute and you could go there. And that's what I did.
Do you have some mentors that were influential either as you were doing your studies or later on that have been kind of very influential on your work?
While I was a student in Germany, I did both my master's and my PhD at Humboldt University. This was a time of great upheaval in Germany after the wall coming down and reunification. The most important person who has really shaped the direction that I went in was Peter Heine, who came to Humboldt in 1993 and who was at the time the only trained anthropologist in Islamic studies in Germany. Historically and traditionally, Islamic studies in Germany is a rather orientalist tradition, very text-focused, very language-focused. And I have always been much more interested in contemporary issues. And he nurtured this interest both in ethnographic work and in contemporary Muslim society. And I don't think without him, I would have been able to go in that direction in the way that I did. When I came to the U.S., after I finished my PhD, I was a postdoctoral fellow at Georgetown for a year and a half. And Donna Esposito and Iman Haddad were at the time very supportive and very helpful in trying to understand how the American academic system and Islamic studies in America are really rather different. And so when I came here, part of the challenge for me was that I didn't have the kind of network of graduate students and mentors that American students usually sort of develop over the course of their graduate school. And so I started from scratch building that kind of network. And there are many people that were really, really important. I mentioned Esposito and Haddad. A little bit later, when I moved to North Carolina, it was Carl Ernst and somewhat later Omid Safi, who are now both colleagues in my department, that were incredibly supportive and helpful and have done all the things that mentors do, including writing recommendation letters for me, because that was one of the challenges that I sort of encountered.
Can you tell us a little bit how this project came about?
Yes. My dissertation research was about Palestinians who had grown up in different diaspora communities and went back to live in Palestine, in the West Bank primarily, after the Oslo Agreement in the 1990s. So it was an ethnographic project. I had spent a significant amount of time in Palestine. I lived there for almost 2 years. And when I came to the U.S., there were sort of two challenges. One was that Palestine studies, not unlike in Germany, but in different ways, is incredibly politicized here. And I was very concerned that I would have a very difficult time getting a job, basically. And I also couldn't travel for a while because I was a new immigrant, so to speak. And I had done some research on Palestinian Americans because part of the group that I was studying of young Palestinian returns were Palestinian Americans. And through that, I had sort of encountered a broader investment that some Palestinian Americans made in the 1990s, especially in American Muslim organizations and American, the American Muslim community more broadly, which is trying to negotiate being Palestinian American, Arab American, and a contingent of them also American Muslim. And I had realized in terms of disciplinary training, I come from an area studies background, that if I wanted to work in U.S. academia, I was probably going to invest much more in religious studies. And so it made sense to start with what I already had, which was sort of a sense of diaspora studies and migration, and integrate that with my interest in Islam and Muslims. And so that's sort of broadly how I got in that direction. And I've had an interest in American Muslim thought, so the work of American Muslim intellectuals, for a longer time. And it was actually, you're not going to believe this, but it was actually surprising for me how I ended up doing work on women. I've always had an interest in gender studies, but I had made sort of a vow to myself to not end up in the gender corner, because it's still a corner in my view. And then somehow, rather naturally, it ended up being a focus on American Muslim women scholars and intellectuals. And the last step was to focus this material, this enormous amount of material. I had pretty much collected everything American Muslim women had ever written and published. And I needed some kind of hook to put that together in some meaningful way, because it was so much material. And so at some point in 2006, I had a student, an undergraduate student, who was doing research, who ended up writing a seminar paper on the woman-led prayer in American Muslim women scholars. And that became the lens to which I looked at this material and selected which things would sort of connect to that. Long story.
That's great. Can you talk about, you mentioned you have this mass amount of data, basically. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about your sources? Because it's both ethnographic, but it's also a lot of text. So can you talk about your sources and how you kind of navigated those?
So it's primarily textual. in the sense that I didn't attend the woman-led prayer. I start by saying that I basically have no idea what I was doing on that day. So it wasn't something that was on my radar. I remember reading about it, but not sort of connecting it to anything academically. And I did make a decision, because I had come from this body of text, to not do real ethnographic research, as in talking to people who were at the prayer or talking to the authors of the text that I had collected, primarily because I would argue that that would have changed the direction of the book tremendously. Because, of course, it would have become much more about how people negotiate their own perceptions of what they've done in the past. And I also didn't want the authors to interpret their writing for me. I wanted to approach the text on their own terms, so to speak. And so, in my view, it's primarily a textual study. And the, what looks ethnographic there, as I see in that chapter, is based on a video recording of the prayer that someone did and that they graciously shared with me.
One of the real unique features of this book is you're basically studying many of your peers and your colleagues. Yes. Could you talk a little bit about that for anyone in the field who might end up doing something like this? What might be some of the challenges of studying your peers?
So really my advice is just study dead people. Because it's so much easier. And I have to say, when I started this, they were less of my peers than they are now. And so this has been one of my great challenges, because as you point out, when you study people that you also know or get to know, you have to deal with what they think about your readings of them. And I have gotten some feedback from various people, especially the ones that are one generation older than me, sometimes a little matronizing about how I read and misread some of their intentions. But that's precisely why I didn't want to do interviews. So, but it is a challenge. And it's also, as I pointed out in the introduction, it's also been a challenge for me, because I negotiate this blurry boundary between analytical work and an investment in the communities, the American Muslim communities that I'm part of, and my own engagement as a scholar who's also an activist of sorts. And so this is a difficult, it was a difficult experience. And I realized that I really quickly get sort of defensive about having to explain this. And in light of the recent discussions about methodology and approaches and which scholars can be held critical, I do think that it is an attempt on my part to demonstrate that this is possible, and that it is an important contribution to scholarship, not one that replaces other kinds, but that is part of the picture. That's sort of how I look at it.
Yeah, I think you're very successful in this.
Thank you.
Even though there's this focal point, this prayer event, which I'm going to ask you to explain in a moment, the book is really about the discourse of gender.
Yeah.
And in the introduction, you note that that gender is now a mainstream discourse within intra-Muslim debates. I'm wondering if you could talk about that. Is there an assumption that these are not debates that are happening, or why gender, and how does it fit in here?
Yeah, so the reason why I point that out there is because the assumption is often that Muslims only talk about gender because everyone from British colonialists to the American mass media make them do that. There's a history of linking the positions of women in Muslim societies to measuring the ability of Muslims to be modern. So there is a colonial discourse, part of the colonial ideology, especially the British colonial ideology, and Leila Ahmed is someone who's done important work on that, that included arguments about how colonizing Egypt in particular, but also other Muslim majority societies, was in part necessary because it would advance the position of women. And so this gender discourses in Muslim, among Muslim reformists and Muslim communities, I think are often represented as reactive, in need of reacting to that. And I think that there is some truth to that being a reaction primarily. And so I wanted to point out that I think in the discourses and debates that I would follow in the book, that I think that American Muslims have mainstream gender discourses in the sense that the scholars and writers and activists I talk about here might not be mainstream in American Muslim communities. They are on the margins. But the discourses themselves, to be able to discuss the roles of women and the ability to be leaders of women, those are, I think, mainstream in the sense that everybody knows that you can't not talk about that. So I wanted to point out that there's at least some degree of agency in having conversations about gender that are not just about proving over and over again that Muslims can be modern, that Islam is compatible with modernity, or American society for that matter.
Let's discuss this kind of focal point that kind of brings all these loose ends together. Can you explain or describe for people who don't know about this, this woman-led prayer in 2005? Can you tell us about who was involved, what exactly happened, and why it was important?
Can I just say that I need to read the book?
You can. Give them a tease.
The event that I describe in much detail in the first chapter of the book took place on March 18, 2005 in the Synod House of St. John's the Divine in New York City. It was a Friday prayer led by Amina Wadud, who led a mixed gender congregation in prayer and who also offered the Friday khutbah. And these are, in Islamic law, two separate functions, so they're both, I think, need to be pointed out. The event was organized, it's actually quite complicated, but by Asra Nomani, who is an American Muslim journalist and writer, who had just published a book called Standing Alone in Mecca, and sort of an autobiographical reflection on American Muslim communities and gender issues, and her own experiences with that. And Salima Abdul-Rasur, who is the editor of a very successful book called Living Islam Out Loud, and an edited collection of American Muslim women's narratives, and Sarah Tantawi. The event was supported by the Progressive Muslim Union. And so there's a very particular direction in which that goes. And in terms of describing the event, so it couldn't take place in a mosque because none of the mosques in New York City were willing to host it. And one of the venues, which was an art gallery, was threatened because the prayer was announced beforehand, I think about a week before, and the debate basically started before it had taken place. In the end, at the Synod House, which is a very beautiful building, there was a lot of security surrounding it because there has been threats. There were about 120 people who participated in the prayer, quite a number of people who were observers, and about 120 or so journalists. Because it had been widely publicized, and there was a lot of interest.
Why is this event important? And also, why you talk about why it's not necessarily unique, right? So could you talk about both sides of this?
So I wanted to make the argument, obviously, that the event was important. Otherwise, I wouldn't have written so much about it. But I also wanted to point out that there was this historical point. So it's not unique, both in the sense that there has been women led prayers before. So women leading mixed gender congregations in prayer is not typical. It's not unprecedented either. And I try to explain that there is actually a longer history to it. But this event is widely publicized. It's basically mediated. And I think that it kicked off a conversation that in that form hadn't happened before. At the same time, and this is versus the question of whether individual actors push history or if history pushes individual actors to do certain things, I would argue that if it hadn't been on that day with that set of people, something very similar would have happened relatively soon. So I want to point out that I think that it is part of something broader that was happening in American Muslim communities in terms of gender debates. And so the symbolic event is significant. But I'm convinced that something similar would have happened even if Asghar Nomani had not organized this particular one, even if Amina Wadud had not agreed to participate in it, even if Asghar Nomani had not wanted to promote her book, which is one of the charges that you find in response to the prayer, something similar would have happened. So it's significant historically, but it's not unique either in happening at all or in happening in the way that it is in the public leadership.
Now, much of the reactions that you discuss in the book kind of followed in two different kind of frameworks, one in kind of legal terms and one in symbolic terms. Can you talk about some of these responses within this debate, the legal and symbolic importance?
Okay. Mm-hmm. So one debate that happened beforehand is whether it is actually in accordance with Islamic law, which becomes the term that's wielded by people as a weapon of debate. And the question here is both whether Islamic law can possibly be interpreted to accommodate the possibility of a woman leading Friday prayers and giving the Friday khutbah. And the other question, and this is important and often gets lost in the conversation, is whether the prayers of the people participating in a Friday prayer led by a woman are valid and accepted by God. So the debate is both about sort of technical aspects of prayer, but ultimately the concern is about whether the prayers are considered valid, because Muslims pray in order to accumulate deeds and fulfill their duties. And so that makes it legally significant. And the majority of the legal discussion point out that there is no support or very little support. What I found really interesting was that what comes out in the debate is that there was actually a historical debate among Islamic legal scholars about whether women can lead prayers. And so we're talking like 9th and 10th century. And I find that really fascinating, because the argument that this is all innovation and that it is a contemporary problem, or that American Muslims are making this trouble because they're bringing gender into the Islamic conversation, is actually not supported by the legal documents that we have, the legal debate that took place in the 9th and 10th century about whether women can lead prayer. So it has come up as a question before. And on the other level, and this is what most of the organizers and early supporters of the prayer, that's the level that they argue on, is that it is a symbolic event, that it is important to do this because it's the one form of women's leadership that hasn't been conquered, and performing this prayer is is making a statement. It's both making a media statement and a statement to communities. And I argue in the book that the intention was to generate discussion and to further an intra-Muslim conversation about these broader issues. And I found in sort of tracing the way in which that debate took place in print, I wasn't able with the methods that I had selected to follow actual discussions in communities. I mean, I did see some of those and I participated in some of those, but that's not sort of comprehensive. But what happens in print, online, and in various kinds of writing is that the legal debate and the symbolic debate don't take place in conversation. They're sort of, what I argue is basically that they're talking past each other. So one side's making legal arguments and the other side is making symbolic arguments. And there isn't really a way in which that will be resolved in any kind of way. So people position themselves in one or the other way.
Now, while certainly not all the people who were involved in the event will self-identify in this way, this term progressive comes up a lot, certainly in the organizers, the Progressive Muslim Union. I'm wondering if you could kind of give us a sense of what does progressive mean to these people who self-identify as progressive?
Mm-hmm. Well, as you point out, a range of things. Some of the people, even who were at one point or the other point involved in the Progressive Muslim Union, are divided about what the progressive part of that means. I see it as an initiative of Muslims who felt, of American Muslims primarily, who felt that they couldn't participate in interpreting their own tradition and translating that into their own life practices because there was this sort of gap between what they were told their tradition was and expected of them and what they were actually be willing and able to live. And the Progressive Muslim Union has a complicated and relatively short history, and I think it's that short and complicated history is a good indicator of how problematic the label is. I mean, if you replace it with liberal, it would still be really problematic and it's invested with meaning in all these different ways. I would look at it as an attempt to be very open to reinterpretation, to be conscious, particularly of gender as a category of interpretation, and to be generally open to significant change in the ways Muslims, and specifically American Muslims, practice their religion.
This is kind of good lead into the third chapter. You talk about gender justice and Quranic mm-hmm. exegesis. And you kind of frame that in this term, embodied tafsir, kind of borrowing from Sheikh's tafsir of praxis. Can you kind of explain what this is, what you mean by this?
Yeah. So a big part of the materials that I looked at are textual reinterpretation. So various women scholars rethinking and rereading the Quran primarily. But I argue that the prayer event fits into that as a pattern because there are in fact other ways of interpreting the Quran. And Sadia Shif, who coined the term Tafsir of Praxis, uses it in a very particular context to argue in her research with survivors of domestic violence in South Africa, Muslim survivors of domestic violence in South Africa, that you can basically live interpretations of the Quran even if you never write down a word of it, that there is a way to live tafsir. And I mean, there are various debates about whether the category of tafsir should be and can be analytically opened up beyond textual interpretation, so writing a commentary on the Quran. And so there are different ways in which this can happen. There are people who have argued that certain fiction, certain literature written by Muslims is in fact tafsir. So there are other ways in which there's a wonderful dissertation by Kamiyuskaya who argues that particular American Muslim intellectuals have offered oral tafsir in their work, for example, W.D. Muhammad. So the category itself is open up beyond the kind of narrow textual interpretation. And so I argue that the prayer event itself is tafsir by bodily movement, by participating in a congregational prayer that embodies these alternative interpretations.
Now this larger kind of gendered exegetical project is often either by the authors themselves or from the outside as feminist, and I'm wondering if you could kind of discuss this term, because some people, you know, adapt and use this term feminism, but a lot of people kind of reject this idea of an Islamic feminism. So can you talk about this a little?
So there are different layers to this conversation. There is the question of whether there is such a thing as Islamic feminism. There is a debate about whether there's a distinction between Islamic and Muslim feminism and what those distinctions might be. And then there is a debate among women, Muslim women scholars and activists also, about whether the term feminist should be used at all. And like all terminology, it's incredibly politicized, and like the term progressive, it's invested with different meaning by different people. The point of contention is often sort of at the intersection of two issues. One is that much of American mainstream feminism has been primarily secular. So many of the earlier feminists, especially in the first wave, were women who thought of religion in general as part of the problem, as an expression of patriarchy, and thus as beyond redemption, to use a very religious term. And of course, they are religious feminists. Both in America and in Europe, there's a rich tradition of Christian feminism and a little bit later Jewish feminism, but they're on the margin of the feminist movement. And the second part of that story for me is that many of the early feminists also used Islam and Muslims as a backdrop for their own for their own advancement, so to speak. So to talk about the oppression of Muslim women was sort of like the worst example of what women can go through and shouldn't be going through. And as other scholars have presented much more eloquently, early feminists, European feminists in particular, were complicit in the colonial project and provided arguments for colonial ideology. And so the term in that sense is tainted. And it has been relatively easy to dismiss scholars and thinkers who use the label feminist for themselves as a Western, quote unquote, outside influence on Muslim society, so as something that is essentially foreign to Muslim societies and communities. So then the argument then is that it is not an indigenous concept, and it is in fact a colonial concept. And so women scholars have had to negotiate what that means for them to use or not use the label. Some use it very comfortably and have actually in fact close connections and draw extensively on existing feminist theory, while others are clearly very uncomfortable with the term and its implications. And so each of the scholars in particular that I primarily scholars who reflect on these dynamics, has a different take on the term and whether they want to use it for themselves or not. And I make the argument that as scholars, we need to be very careful in using the term for people who refuse it, as a label for themselves, because I think that it does, sort of violence to their own self-representation and self-perception to force a term on them that they are not willing to employ for a variety of reasons.
Yeah. Now you go through several authors, and of course there's differences between these. But can you talk? Just give us kind of a understanding of what are some of the shared characteristics of these American Muslim women exegetes.
Yes. Well, the first thing is that they don't share participation in a movement. I'm very reluctant to represent them as a movement, so to speak. Many of them in both the first wave in the 1980s and 90s, and then into the 2000s, have, I think, primarily seen themselves as lone fighters for their own cause. They have a number of things in common that they negotiate in different ways. I think the most important one is, as I pointed out in that chapter, their assumption that gender justice or gender equality or sometimes even gender egalitarianism are a given. So that's not negotiable, and their assumption is that this is God's will. God wants gender justice, and they have somewhat differing and pretty elaborate framework for arguing that. And all of the ones that I look at in this particular context have focused their work on the Quran. And to varying degrees, engaged with the Sunnah, with Hadith tradition, but both reject much of the Hadith tradition to varying degrees, and reject most of the existing exegesis on the Quran, the exegetical tradition, as patriarchal and thus inherently misogynist, which in turn explains why they need to come up with these new interpretations. And so another thing that they have in common is that they argue that new interpretation is necessary and required of Muslims in particular eras and centuries.
Just so we can get through at least a larger portion of the book. In the following chapter, you talk about women's rights and Islamic law. I'm wondering if you could give us a sense of how American Muslim women have worked through some of these debates revolving around women's rights and gender equality in legal terms.
Mm-hmm. So these are two really different kinds of categories, right? So like on the one hand, part of the chapter engages with women scholars and activists who employ a human rights framework for talking about Muslim women's rights, which, as we know, has a long history. So human rights don't drop out of the sky, but are a product of European 20th century post-World War II history, and are very sort of determined by that history and by primarily European powers and politics. And so there is a debate about whether the way in which women's rights are defined as universal, as part of the universal human rights tradition, is actually applicable to Muslim society, or whether there's something that both concentrates power in the hands of Europeans and those of later Americans to define what women's rights are, or whether there is, in fact, a way to participate in this conversation on an equal level. And so there are activists who have adopted a human rights framework to talk about women's rights. You can argue about whether that's effective and successful, but some people have a real investment in that. And then there is another group, and there's relatively little overlap, I would argue, there, who say, well, the Quranic exegesis and the reinterpretation is really important, but how this translates into real changes in Muslim communities and societies is through Islamic law and through interpretation of Islamic law, which is something that the majority of the Quranic exegetes, women exegetes, don't do. So there's a sort of a distinction here. And so the engagement with Islamic law goes along similar lines. It's an argument about whether Islamic law needs to entirely be reinterpreted, whether you can retain methods but change outcomes, or whether Islamic law should become completely irrelevant because it cannot be reformed. And so we have a whole spectrum of ways in which women scholars engage with Islamic law. It's a smaller group, I would argue, than the Quranic exegetes, and there is more of a conversation about that, but so placing the human rights discourse and the Islamic law discourse in one chapter was more a matter of space than that they're actually really connected with each other.
You also talk about the role of authority and and how women have begun to establish themselves in roles of authority. Can you talk about this idea of kind of traditional sources of authority and then some of the factors that allow women to now step up into these roles?
Mm-hmm. So very broadly speaking, I think the question of religious authority is one of the key questions that I see in religious studies and that has shaped and transformed Islamic studies in particular in significant ways. And so I would argue that this isn't only about women's authority, but that putting it in the context of gender is just focusing it in a particular way. And so Muslim women, in part, to argue with Khalid Abu Fadl, can step into positions of authority or claim various forms of religious authority because there is a transformation that takes place in the 19th and 20th century in the way authority is constituted in Muslim society. It's both a sort of democratization process that in part has to do with the availability of the Quran. It has to do with the with development in the application of Islamic law, going along with nation state development. And then, of course, there is a particular American story to the ways in which how Muslims who live as religious minorities in majority societies that have nothing to do with Islamic law negotiate application of Islamic law to their own life. So where they're not applied by the state or in a sort of societal fashion, how does Islamic law actually function in that context? And authority here is both the authority to interpret and authority to offer legal opinions. And I think this is actually where they're most connected. And so the debate about religious authority in American Muslim communities is really complicated, not only, it's not all the women's fault. There are other questions about who inherits, who inhabits positions of authority and how American Muslims determine for themselves, sources of authority. And I make a distinction between, authority that is invested in people like scholars and leaders, and authority that is claimed by those leaders and scholars. And of course, they're not entirely independent of each other, but I do think that there's a way in which someone can step into a position and claim religious authority and then needs to build what I describe as interpretive community. So has to convince others of their authority to do what they actually do. And I do think that women have, Muslim women have negotiated positions of authority in a variety of ways, and that the claim to ritual leadership that the book starts with is actually sort of like a last last frontier in that regard, because as I would argue in many other areas, women have actually advanced into positions of leadership, in particular communally, and there's a certain acceptance, at least for women, as chronic exegetes. And so the question of Islamic law and then the question of ritual leadership, I think, are where there is still quite a bit of space to move further.
Can you talk a little bit about education or institutional training, how that factors into the debates revolving around women's authority?
Yeah. That too, part of a bigger question about how especially American Muslims become scholars and leaders in their own right. And so I would argue that there are several different models and ways in which that works. One is to acquire training in various Muslim majority countries. So to look for authenticity of the tradition outside of the U.S. Zarina Gorval has done really amazing work on that question. One second. The ways in which the authority to interpret and lead is derived from authentic sources that are described as authentic because they are in sort of the heartland of the Muslim tradition. And of course, there are alternatives. There are educational institutions of a variety of sorts in the American context, both online and actual physical spaces. And the scholars in particular that I looked at in the book are all people who have American secular degrees in everything from Islamic studies to political science. And so this question of what of that actually enables them to do the work that they do is part of the question of their pedigree and legitimacy. And so this question of traditional versus secular training in Islamic studies or the Islamic sciences is, I think, at the heart of this question of who has authority. But as I pointed out, I would argue that that whether somebody is actually recognized as authoritative and legitimate depends more on their interpretation than their pedigree. So someone who also has Islamic studies training from a Western institution can be invested and perceived as having legitimacy and authority because their interpretations are in line with what is perceived as the traditional status quo. And that goes across gender lines. I think that the push isn't primarily against women as scholars and leaders. It's about particular interpretations that communities as collective bodies push back against.
In the next chapter, you place this authority into a physical space. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about not only the role of women as ritual leaders, but what is the role of women within the mosque, particularly in North America?
Mm-hmm. So this is sort of a chapter in the middle of the book, which is actually kind of ironic because the idea for the woman-led prayer grew out of Asrar Nomani's frustration with the way mosques space was allocated in her mosque. So it starts out as an expression of serious disagreement with the spaces, the physical spaces, and also the symbolic spaces that women have in American mosques. Now, part of the issue here is that American mosques fulfill a number of functions that traditional mosques historically in Muslim majority contexts didn't have, because they are centers of community organizing and community life in ways that a traditional mosque didn't have to be because there were other venues where that could take place. And women have been involved in mosque building and mosque usage since there have been mosques in the American context, in the U.S. context. And so the question of where their space is for them is both a question of architecture, which is a whole other debate about whether American mosques should be traditional or modern or something in between, or whether they should fit into the landscape or not. And part of that is that they're very, very, there's a range of ways in which women are or are not participating in congregational prayer in mosques in different regions of the Muslim majority world. And some of these debates are brought here. And so there's a range of practices associated both with whether women participate in congregational prayers and where they do that, if they do that. So we have everything from the basement space for women to an occasional place where you can find men and women praying side by side in separate sections. And really everything in between, from a physically entirely removed space to a space that is used by men and women at the same time. And this isn't only about participating in prayer and being able to see the imam and hear the imam reading the prayer, but it's also about participating in lectures, being able to ask questions, and a question that comes up all the time, which is whether women can actually lecture to men in mosque spaces. These are negotiations of how to have mosques as religious spaces in the American context, and questions about how women can be accommodated and incorporated into those kinds of spaces. And it is very clear, especially from the more historical research in the earlier 20th century, that women were essential participants in community building. And so some of this is actually the development away from somewhat more inclusive environments space-wise, even though I think it's clear to me as well that there are more women involved in mosque organizing and community work than there were earlier, like maybe 6 or 7 years ago.
Within this context of space, you also talk about the voice. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you could tell us kind of the direct and symbolic significance of the woman's voice in the mosque.
So I was already alluding to that when I was talking about whether women can ask questions to speakers or whether women can actually give lectures in mosques to men. And the underlying discourse is one that is actually quite modern, as in there is a very conservative discourse about Muslim women's voices that points out that Muslim women voices are part of what makes them sexual temptation for men, and thus there are various limits that can be placed based on that argument on who women can speak to. This can extend to Quran recitation, call to prayer, singing, speaking on radio or television, and speaking to men that are not part of their immediate family. And so it's a spectrum that inhabits. And in terms of participation, clearly when one is not able to speak in a community setting, that has repercussions for their participation. And in the context of the prayer, this question of women's voices comes up both in the fact that the Azan, the call to prayer, was founded by a woman in March 2005, and that obviously Amina Wadud used her voice both to give the khutbah and lead the congregation in prayer. And so this question of whether women's voices, really just practically speaking, can and should be heard by men and what that means is not the biggest part of this conversation, but it certainly is significant. And then the question of voice comes in the symbolic way in many of the statements by the organizers of the prayer, who represent the prayer as a way to giving voice to women in this very symbolic and significant way.
What happens to the media representations of Muslim women when we take American Muslim self-representations into account?
Several things. One is that, as I said, I think one of the purposes of the organizers in publicizing the event beforehand and having this significant number of journalists and cameras and voice recorders at the event was to challenge media representations, and I'm using media here broadly because I don't have time to separate it out. I'm very aware that there are very different kinds of dynamics that work in different forms of media, but to challenge what they see as stereotypical misrepresentations of Muslim women as silent and oppressed and not able to say or do anything. Because clearly here you have a group of women and men who support what they're doing, who are speaking very loudly, who are doing what they intend to do and who have things to say. So I think part of the purpose was to challenge media representation. I argue in that chapter, though, that in a way, each of the main actors also stepped into already existing media frames on two levels. One is that the sort of lonely fighter representation that both Asra Nomani and Amina Wajid fall into, Nomani much more willingly than Wajid, I think, basically means that they really confirm what this media frame already represents, which is that they are an exception to the norm, which is that Muslim women are oppressed. So they are examples of women who are trying to sort of shake off this oppression, but they are an exception. And the other really big danger that I see, and I don't know that I've seen that reflected upon enough in my view, is that the representation of American Muslim women maybe more broadly as less oppressed than other women in Muslim majority societies. So comparing Asra Nomani to women in Afghanistan, for example, or Asra Nomani writing about women in Saudi Arabia is so very different from her, actually reinforces the idea that Muslim women in Muslim majority societies are even more oppressed. And so there is sort of there's this way in which self-representation and claiming the right to self-represent is often really well intentioned. And I'm not saying that it isn't also changing things over time, but I do think that there is a significant danger in assuming that that's actually going to break the stereotypes, so to speak, or to speak in the title of one of the books that I looked at, Shattering the Stereotypes. Because I think it often doesn't do that, it does the opposite.
Now, I don't want to take up too much of your time, but there's one other thing that I want to note. Now, I really like in the conclusion that you don't just kind of wrap it up for us. What I really appreciate is you take a moment to kind of reflect on what you've left out and how your study can kind of lead to other examinations within this kind of discourse of gender. And I wanted to ask you, though, since you've kind of talked about this mass of data that you have, and you have a chapter on these memoirs or these personal writings, you don't really talk about the hijab at all in the in the book until this conclusion, but you talk about the hijab in relation to these book covers on this since 2001 fairly well-developed kind of literature. Can you talk about how the hijab kind of is situated here?
Yes. So I took the advice of two of my colleagues and friends, Lorena Grobal and Rosemary Hicks, at a workshop we were at together, I think in 2008, where they both said, don't have a chapter on hijab, because it will basically take over the entire book. And of course, the question of hijab and women covering women's bodies is all over this literature that I looked at, especially the memoirs and narratives. And I was really concerned that it would sort of hijack all the other analysis. And there is plenty of literature on hijab among American Muslims and more generally. And so I'm frankly a little bit tired of having this conversation. And
well, forgive me then.
No. It's just that I really didn't want it to hijack the entire book, and putting it in one chapter that I really didn't want to write that much in a book that was already longer than my publisher was happy with. So it wasn't a very difficult decision. But then the question of the book covers was sort of a way to get away with that, to say, I acknowledge that that's there, and I'm glad that other people are doing it. I just want to point out how this works in the context of the book covers, and just I want to point out that I'm very, very proud of my book cover. And this wasn't that easy. I approached my editor and I said, look, now that I have this segment in the concluding chapter about book covers, I want to point out that it would be really ridiculous if you came up with a cover design that had a woman with hijab on it. And he said, well, yeah, I kind of see the point. So what do you want? And so I sort of went back and forth, and eventually we ended up with this, which is a picture I took myself to show them what I had in mind. And then basically just took the photograph that I took and said, okay, we're going to put that there. I'm very proud of that, because the politics of book covers, as you see in that concluding chapter, are really complicated. And I was very worried about looking like a real idiot talking about the politics of book covers and then ending up with some version of the hijabi woman on my cover. So I'm proud that I won that. But it's also because it's a university publisher who was open to that conversation.
Yeah, it is a very beautiful book as well. So for those listeners who can get their hands on it. Before I let you go, can you tell us a little bit about what you're working on now, or what might be coming out in the future, so that we can explore your work further?
Sure. So one thing I'm happy to report is that a chapter that didn't make it into a book on the dynamics of Muslim women scholars in American academia actually ended up being properly written and finished, and it will be part of the Cambridge Companion to American Islam that Umi Safi and I have been editing, that should come out sometime next year. So that I was very happy that I found a space there to include something that I couldn't fit into the book, because I think it would have been good to sort of finish that up. And the new project that I'm working on is an attempt, I think it's working really well, but yet it's still an attempt at this point, to connect textual and ethnographic work. I am working on a project tentatively called Peaceful Families, American Muslim Efforts Against Domestic Violence. So I'm not looking at the fact that there is domestic violence in Muslim communities, but at what American Muslims have done since about the 1980s in order to address domestic violence in their communities. And so they will eventually, inshallah, be a book. I've written several shorter pieces that engage with aspects and segments of that, and so that's what's been taking up most of my time. And in an interesting way, it's a very logical extension of this book that we're talking about here, in the sense that one of the inspirations for it was that some of the Quranic exegesis that I studied had to do with verse 434, which is a key verse for questions of marital hierarchy and the disciplining of wives. And some of the exegetes that I studied had important and significant things to say about that. And so there's a direct link between that verse and that work I'm doing now. And the other important step for me is that it takes me away from exclusively focusing on women, which I've increasingly argued isn't really gender studies, to looking at both men's and women's approaches to questions of marriage, marital hierarchy, gender roles, and domestic violence in that context.
Excellent. That sounds great. Well, thanks again for making the time to talk to me. It was certainly enjoyable. I'm sorry that we weren't able to get to. You really pack a lot into this book, so I encourage all the listeners to explore it further, because we only scratched the surface. But
and there's one thing that I want to say that I'm actually really proud of. Some scholars in the academy are very proud of writing books that most people can't understand. I'm actually really most proud that I think the book has come out to be really accessible. And the main reason for that is that I wrote it with my own students in mind. I wanted to have a text that I could give them to explain the things in the way that I teach. And so I think it is very accessible for undergraduate students. So as a bit of self-promotion, I think it's both scholarly but also accessible on the level that most of our students will be on.
I would agree, 100%.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks again.
Thank you. Take care.
Thanks for listening to my conversation with Julianne Hammer about her wonderful book, American Muslim Women, Religious Authority, and Activism, More Than a Prayer, which came out with University of Texas Press this summer in 2012.